you guys did a parade to launch like your free plan. And it was hilarious. Like, I remember being like, how much time did they spend on this? Like trombone, like the whole thing.
Yeah. The marching band came with floats and stuff. Yeah.
And how do you attribute that? Right. How do you say that that did, you know, like I've never worked for a company where I would have ever been able to sell a parade. That was always just really interesting to me. And I interviewed you about this. Not that this is my podcast, you know, put me in my place, but I had you on and I asked you in email, and I've used this quote a bunch of times, where I asked you, like, why are you the way that you are? Because I didn't want to get too tactical and like, why did you? Like, why are you like this?
Welcome to Talking Too Loud, the show that's serving up the loudest takes on building businesses, top-notch products, and unforgettable brands. You just heard John Bonini, founder of Content Brands, ask one of my favorite questions. Why are we like this? Why do we and other brands do things that make no sense on paper, like launch a free plan with a parade? Or create a web series that never mentions their product? Shout out to MailChimp. Well, according to John, the most successful companies are the ones who treat content like a product, something worth investing in, experimenting with, and even getting a little weird about. In today's interview, we unpack the difference between brands that publish content and true content brands. We talk about why creating fans are as important as winning customers, and why, in the age of AI, brands need more soul. John, so good to see you.
Likewise, my friend.
It's been a while.
This is different because I think I've had you on my podcast two or three times. So usually I'm in your seat, not your actual seat, but like the host seat. So this is fun. Yeah.
I'm excited to turn the tables on you. That's what we're here to do.
So. Let's go. Yeah.
Let's go. And obviously, we have to start with the first hard-hitting question. You know, the show is called Talking Too Loud because when I get excited, I cannot control the volume of my voice. I know you are similar.
Yes.
But today, it would be nice to know, what's got you talking too loud?
Oh, boy. Well, first, you know, I have to repeat the crack that I just gave you a couple seconds ago. I have five kids, so I'm always talking too loud. But as you can
see... What's the age range there?
9 to 2. So,
okay.
Yeah, we have... I'm on the side of the kids who know how to get in the car and buckle themselves in, which is like your life starts over when that happens, all the way down to, you know, the child still putting in buckle. Yeah. So yeah, we're right in the thick of it, but we're talking, what's got me talking too loud. This is very apropos. I'm a big baseball fan, as you could see from the posters in the background, big Yankees fan. And my mental health is going to take a big decline this week because the Yankees and Red Sox are playing in a playoff series.
Uh-oh.
And things always go great when that happens. So yeah, that's going to take up much more of my emotional bandwidth than I think I'm prepared for this week. But anyways, yeah, that's about it.
Do you scream at the TV? Are you a TV screamer?
It depends if the kids are in the room or not. I try to set a better example, but yes, I do. The answer is yes. I scream.
It's hard. I think it's like a pure instinct, right?
It is. Yeah. I think, which is fine, except the words that come out maybe is that part I have to work on. But I think I do okay at.
Yeah.
But, man, it's tough to be, to be a passionate sports fan, I think, and care probably way too much than you should. It should be fun. I enjoy it. So
I'm sure it'll be great. I'm sure there won't be much drama at all.
Yeah. not at all. Yeah. No. It'll be fine. Yeah. It'll be fine.
Okay. Well, let's get loud about content. So, you've said there's a big difference between publishing content and being a true content brand. What is a content brand, and why does it matter?
Yeah, so it feels very ironic to be answering this question on this show because Wistia was always the example I use to so many people who ask that question. But the way I think about it is it's building a following and building a reputation around your ideas, not just your product or service. I think there are certain brands, companies, teams that treat content almost like it's its own product. They invest in it like it's its own product. They do audience research like it's its own product. You know, they dedicate resources to it like it's its own product, and they kind of give it that respect that you would any product that you're, you know, dedicating engineering resources to. So I think it's really about treating content in such a way that you're building a following around the content itself, outside of what you do as a service or what your product does. And so that's how I've always sort of thought about it. And the idea really came about a few years ago. I was, I think, right at the precipice of going solo. And I wrote this newsletter called Becoming a Content Brand. And the reason why I was inspired to write this, and you know, I BS you not, I know I'm on the Wistia podcast, but, you know, I was...
No, go on, please.
The newsletter was and still is for, you know, and I know it's this way for a lot of people, my outlet for testing out new ideas. Much like a stand-up comedian might go to a small club and test out jokes, see what gets laughs, see what doesn't. The newsletter has always been that for me. So I had this idea. I was like, what does Wistia do well? Like, why do I always use them as an example for content? And what I thought about was I had started following Wistia probably when I was in the agency world, like 2011. I didn't become a paying customer of Wistia until I led marketing at Databox in 2017. In that 6 years, I was referring Wistia to other people. If people asked, like, oh, like it was, you know, I'm referring a tool to people that I've never actually used myself.
Yeah.
And that's either irresponsible or there's something else going on here. And Wistia wasn't the only tool that I used in that example. Buffer was another one, right? There were others. And I had developed such an affinity for Wistia just through the content over the years. And I had become such a massive follower and a believer in the brand that it was almost like, oh yeah, the product must be good too, right? Like they put this much thought into the content. They've been this helpful. To me, there's an obvious choice. When I got to Databox and we started investing in podcasting and video, I was like, yeah, Wistia. Like it wasn't even a question. We didn't evaluate anything else. We didn't think about anything else. It was Wistia. And so that idea kind of spurred this, like, what is that? Like, why was I referring them to other people for 6 years and I had never used the product? And yeah. So I was like, they kind of built a brand separate from the product, all about content. And so I was like, oh, content, brand, wrote about it, and it absolutely took off. So much so that I named my consultancy Content Brands and kind of went all in on it. And here we are. So that's a long-winded way of not only defining what a content brand is, but kind of giving you the inspiration behind kind of where it came from.
Yeah. Well, look, I love that obviously for many reasons, not just because it's about Wistia. But I also think it's just interesting to think about and hear from your perspective. Because, right, like I was in it, growing it, building it, like, and I can remember there's certain moments that stick out when we were making the call to treat the content like a product. And it was often a scary moment. It was like, should we really do like 110, 100? Should we really do it? Like, should we really spend this much money on these ads? And I remember we'd had the whole thing ready to go. And then I got that call the night before. There was like, can I actually send the check for this? And it was like, no, yeah, we need to, because this is going to be how we learn. And there's all these different ways it can work out. And then in hindsight, it seemed obvious, right? It was like a lot of these things, like, you know, the content represents the brand, the content brand. But I think it's interesting too, because like I definitely do the same thing that you're talking about, which is I come across a brand or even a person representing a brand.
Yep.
And they start to take up space in my mind around a topic, and I'll start recommending them, sometimes even without using the product. But it's for the exact same reason you're talking about, which is, well, I can tell that their values are on display in some way. Mm-hmm. I have an idea of what they're an expert at. And if they're an expert at that thing, their solution should probably be pretty darn good.
Right. Right.
And I think that's like a pretty interesting idea by itself, because I think we hear about that a lot in sales, for example. Like whoever can describe the problem best usually wins, even if their solution isn't the best. Yeah. Because it just, we believe that if someone understands a problem really well, then they must be able to come up with a good solution.
Right, right. And SparkToro is another one. That's another example.
Yeah, totally.
I've never used the product. I mean, I'm friendly with Rand and friendly with Amanda Natividad, so I've seen it. I may have tried like a trial, but I'm not an active user of it, but I refer it all the time to clients, to people in my network. And that, so that's like a one that's happening now. Like Wistia, I've been a user now, so my referrals come twofold. But SparkToro is another recent example. And I think that's a really powerful thing to create, right? And so for you, I think for Wistia, one of the things, I don't know how long ago this was, but you guys did a parade to launch like your free plan. And it was hilarious. Like, I remember being like, how much time did they spend on this?
Yeah.
Like trombone, like the whole thing.
Yeah. The live band, the marching band came.
And, you know,
with floats and stuff. Yeah.
And how do you attribute that? Right. How do you say that that did, you know, like most teams, I've never worked for a company where I would have ever been able to sell a parade, like, you know, ever. So that was always just really interesting to me. And I interviewed you about this. Not that this is my podcast, you know, put me in my place. But I had you on, and I asked you in email, and I've used this quote a bunch of times in newsletters and you know, just podcasts like this, where I asked you, like, why are you the way that you are? Because I didn't want to get too tactical and like, why did you, like, why are you like this? Like, why will you do a parade? Why will you do 110, 100? Like, why? And you said something, I'm paraphrasing, but you said something like, we always felt like we didn't need to time the moment that somebody, you know, needed Wistia or would become a customer. We did all these other things because we felt like we'd build up, you know, affinity, and they would, when it came time, they would think of us. And yeah, so I think that's the thing right there that I kind of really zero in on and locked in on, which is like, more people need to be thinking like this, more brands need to treat their content like this. And it only became more important, I think. I went solo 2 years ago, and I think it's become more important now with AI and all this. So, it's I just think it's a really powerful thing to create and kind of build momentum around.
I'm curious what both of you, do you think it's easier to be a brand like that these days? I know you think it's more important to be a brand like that, but is it easier or harder? Because I feel like we've also seen data kind of like move to the top of the pedestal, like you must do what the data says.
Yeah. Define easier first. That's a rhetorical question. But I think it's easy from the standpoint of it starts in you, internal to the earned insights of leadership, like what their experiences are, what their observations are about the market, what their points of view are from having been in the space for however many years. That's easy. What's hard is so many people are kind of what you were just saying. They're trained not to listen to those things instead of looking at what competitor A is doing or what the data in a SEO tool or some other tool tells us that we should be doing and what people are asking. So we should do that instead. I call that like secondhand strategy. Like, you can never own that. Like, if I look at a competitor and say like, oh, they're doing a pod, I should probably do that too.
Yeah.
I can't own it now.
It doesn't work.
And I also can't own a keyword that, oh, this gets, you know, 20,000 searches a month and the difficulty's, you know, not too bad, but I can never own that. So that I think that part's hard. The getting over the, but I need to be doing what everything else says I should be doing, what competitor ABC are doing, we're not. I feel like we should be doing those things. It doesn't really matter what I think. Like, it's all about what the audience wants to know and what they think. I think that push and pull is very hard, but if you buy into it, I think it's easy because it's reliant on things that you already know, inherent to your beliefs and your experiences and your space, things that only you know. All those earned insights from being in Wistia's, you know, case, the video and now podcasting space for, I don't even know how long. I'll feel old. 20, going on 20 years?
19 years, yeah.
19 years. So, yeah.
It's, no, and I would say I think it's never been more important. I agree with you 100%. Brand has never been more important, mm-hmm. and being able to stick out and be different has never been more important, right? Like today, you know, people aren't yet spinning up clones of every product with AI, but like they kind of are attempting it. It's going to happen at some point, right? It doesn't really matter if it happens next year or 10 years, like it's going to happen. So being different is important. I also think you said something in there, just like copying the secondhand strategy thing. Mm-hmm. I've seen so many people make this mistake. I've seen people make this mistake at Wistia where they're like, oh, I see competitor XYZ is doing something. We need to do that too. And it's like, you don't know if that's working or not. And it may work for them and never work for us.
But yeah.
You don't know, just like we don't know. And if you're just copying everything that other people are doing, people are running tests all the time that don't work. You're going to start copying things that don't work. So you have to do things that match your own strategy.
And to that point, before you go on, before we move on from that point, I can't tell you how many marketers I've talked to, friends, guests I've had on podcasts that you'll be like, oh, that thing you did, loved that. And they were like, yeah, that didn't, it didn't work. We killed that. I was like, really? Like,
wow.
Or like, so there was a well-known brand I won't mention, but they had a really
just
good
say it and we'll bleep it. Don't worry about it.
They had a great show, and this was doubly the conflict because I knew the person producing the show, mm-hmm. and which was a third party person that they hired. And I was talking to somebody internal, and I was like, "Oh, how did that go? Like, it was so good. The marketing you did for it." And they were like, "Yeah, it didn't move the needle on anything." And it's like, so if someone else copied that or looked at that, like I said, I can't tell you how many times I've brought up something to a marketer and they've been like, yeah, we've spent a lot of time on that. Didn't really do much. And so yeah. like you said, you just don't know.
You just don't know. And yeah. You know what it makes me think of? There are things that we have done that if you asked me 6 months after, I would have told you it didn't work. Mm. And if you asked me 6 years later, I'll tell you it did.
Now, is that because the sort of like that the gift of time had you look at it differently, or yes, did it actually take that
basically
long?
Yeah. Almost always it was that our expectations were too high to start, and we didn't understand that we actually had something working better than we could have imagined.
Yeah,
I mean, the most obvious example I could talk about is Brandwagon.
Loved I
Yeah. So Brandwagon, show that I hosted, late night style TV show, came out weekly, interviews with guests about brands. We were insane and we made the trailer for it, having not shot a single episode. We released it, announcing the launch date for like 4 weeks later. And then we had to set about starting to go. And we didn't have any episodes banked every single week. We found someone to interview. We pulled all the prep. We like bought a car and converted the brand. It was wild. We released all on our own website. And it got like, I think the top episode at the time got like 10,000 views or something. 10,000 plays on the website.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like 30,000 visitors or something. But across all of them, lots of time watched, whatever. Super proud of what we were making it, super proud of it week to week. But then after, we're like, man, the production of this was insane. We can't keep it up.
We bought a car. Like you
got- Yeah, we just went so far above like and beyond what we were actually should have been able to, what we could maintain basically, that we eventually ended up saying, well, this wasn't really worth it. And then COVID happened actually. So it was 2019. So then COVID happened. We're like, well, I guess we can't do that in person. We'll just wait. We just kind of waited. And I cannot tell you the number of people who remember it well, talk about it fondly. Yeah. Over time, it ended up influencing like huge number of customers and deals and traffic. The numbers were incredibly good, especially for being on our website. But because our expectation was like, we're going to get 100,000 views an episode, we gave it up. And I think that like the framing going into it, it was the problem. And I think if we had looked at it instead of like, hey, if we could get 5,000 views on our website for this, like, or 5,000 right. plays, this probably is a hit and this should be a signal to do more of this. And so often with those things that are hard to measure, that's what it looks like. It's like, you know, it starts qualitatively good. People give up because quantitatively it's not there.
Yeah.
And then eventually realize quantitatively it is there.
Yeah, there's an element of trying the time to market there, which is
exactly. What, and what we made our own mistake in that.
Whereas like 6 years later, all of a sudden, a lot of people are mentioning that show. That's how they first heard of you. Somebody else shared it with them.
Exactly.
Like, that compound interest of investing in something like that isn't going to show up, like by definition, in month one or quarter one.
Exactly. And I think that this is the hard part, is like, how do you get yourself, and you said this before, trusting your instincts from this like earned experience.
Yeah.
And quoting me of like basically not trying to time the market. Yeah, yeah. and like get yourself actually in that mindset and take some of the effort that you're putting into this and say, hey, just like a software product, if you're going to build it and you have a spike at launch and then it comes down, but people keep using it and the retention gets better and you better understand how people are using it, whatever. Yeah, you can trust that over time you'll turn that into something really big.
Yeah.
You have to do that with content too. But it means actually caring when people give you the qualitative feedback, right? Like it means actually listening to it and looking at it and saying, no one is going to say anything about this unless they care.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of like, investing in a 401k and quitting after 3 months. Like, oh, I'm not a millionaire yet. Well, you didn't give it, you didn't give the compound interest a chance to work.
Totally.
It's the same thing with content. And there's a whole rabbit hole to go down here, but we've developed these bad habits from channels like SEO, where it's like, we want to see the opportunity in the data, and then we want to see the return quickly. And if it's not there, well, then we'll pick something else. And yeah, like Brandwagon, perfect example of something that probably isn't going to serve that right away. But like, I remember appreciating that show so much because of the fine tuning to the detail, like the intro, like you had like
a little set.
But not only that, but somebody's hand would come in and like cut a thread off of a. I was like, you didn't need to do that. But it was like ridiculous things like that that I'm sitting here now still remembering, and I think plays a role in why you refer a company or a product to somebody.
You know, it's really fun being on your podcast.
Well, my podcast is Louder Than Words. Yours is called Talking Too Loud. So we knew
there's symmetry.
This was going to happen.
You know, I actually want to go back a little bit because we're talking about how you measure the stuff and treating it like a product. But you also said something in there when you're talking about SparkToro that maybe can be a good example for us, which is SparkToro and Rand has created all these fans. And a lot of these people may never buy SparkToro, as you're saying, right? Yep. Let's just go deeper there. Let's go deeper on that group, the people who aren't going to buy, but who are going to be a fan. And I mean, you've gone so deep on this. This is your whole practice at this point. Like, how should people think about this? What do those people look like? Like, what's the value in a fan who is not going to be a customer?
What is the value in that? Well, first, you brought up Rand. Rand is a two-time content brand creator. Like, he did this with Moz, right? Built a community on it, like, right? And now he's doing again with SparkToro. But what's the value of it? I mean, we were just kind of talking about this, right? Like, it's that word of mouth, it's that community, it's that evangelism that you create by giving your audience something, you know, the 90% of which is not ready to buy anything right now, giving them something to invest in, right? Almost like a, you know, we were talking about, you know, irrationally passionate sports fans earlier, right? Like for a fan of a brand, the content, the shows, the podcasts that they listen to every week, right? You've given them something to invest in and relate to. And the power in that is, well, one, there may come a time where, like, much like me 6 years later, where I needed a video hosting platform and Wistie was it. There was no, that was the shortest. You never heard from us, right? Like, we signed up, paid, we were customers. And so that's the very direct path, right? They become customers eventually. But the other more powerful thing is, over those 6 years, how many people did I refer to Wistia? How often did I refer to Wistia or give an example in the content I was writing, the podcasts I was recording, the speeches I gave at Inbound or wherever, right? You can't really quantify that. And if you could build that at scale, you know, and people that might be listening be like, well, we don't have the budget to like make a show. It's less about that. And we could get into like how to do it, because I know right now we're talking about what the value is in it. But if you could create that opportunity to allow people to invest their time into you before they actually need you from a product or service standpoint, all of a sudden it makes customer acquisition a little easier down the road, right? You don't have to work so hard to time the moment. To steal your quote, which is actually really expensive, right? Like,
yeah,
I work, like, I can't tell you how many people I work with where, because this stuff doesn't work for them, what they do is they invest in paid search, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. But when you're reliant on that for your entire business, or they go and sponsor webinars, or maybe not, or, and in addition to paid search, they're sponsoring webinars or sponsoring newsletters. You know, they're buying booths that, and they're not doing these things as additives. They're doing it out of a set. They have to do these things to drive customer acquisition because they don't have that sort of, you know, affinity built up, right? That trust, that an audience that's already like, oh, I've been listening to your podcast for years, or I've been reading the newsletter or watching the show. And so I think that's the critical part, is it makes acquisition down the road not only easier, but cheaper. And especially now with SEO not working as well as it used to, and all these channels kind of drying up, all of a sudden brands are like, we don't have anything to fall back on. They have to spend money. And your quote about timing the moment, that is incredibly expensive to do. And if you have the funds to do it, awesome, right? Like if you're a well-funded company or you're a public company. But for a lot of folks listening, they're not those things. And it's incredibly expensive and probably not sustainable. I think not only does that get into the value in it, but also like what happens when you don't have that built up is you end up spending a lot more, I think, for customer acquisition than you were probably prepared to do.
Yeah. I agree 100%. It's that planning for the future, planting those seeds, making it much easier later so that you don't have to be as reactive and things are not as expensive, right?
Right.
That is the key. But that sounds great. How do you do it? How should people think about actually pulling this off?
Yeah. So we kind of hinted at this earlier. And it's funny because when I first got into this, I would work with brands who I would start on the content. And then what I realized after months or, you know, of doing it is like there's a lot of foundational items they didn't have first that make making your content into a content brand much harder, right? They don't have a unique way of framing the problem yet. It's very generic. It's what everyone else is saying in their space, or it's like solution driven, you know, grow your pipeline by 10, right? Like there's no recognizable problem there. Mm-hmm. I realized I need to go back and work on those things with them before, because then the content piece becomes a lot easier. So like, how do you do it? It's really about the foundation. I like alliteration. So I think about it in terms of like 5 P's. Sounds very college textbooky. But you know, like the problem, how you frame it, like, do you have a unique way of framing the problem? Your position around the solution. Do you have a unique way of position? Why your approach is different? Why it's preferred? What informs it? Those kind of things. Your first principles, like what are the things you believe? What are the rules about this that maybe others don't? What are your contrarian takes on the space that maybe others are investing in and thinking about that you're like, no, they shouldn't be doing that, and vice versa? What are the things other people think are not worth it that you do, right? Like really defining what those core principles are to your brand, to your company. Then it starts to get into content, which is like, what is the premise of it, right? Like, don't just have a newsletter that shares, curates links to your blog or shares hiring news or funding announcements or another podcast that just does standard Q&A that doesn't really have a discernible premise to it. Like develop, what is the unique premise? That's usually informed by their problem framing and the positioning. And then the last thing is like their packaging. Like how do they take like a podcast like Talking Too Loud or a newsletter like Amanda writes at Spark Toro? And then how do they use that to take the raw material from that and inform it as LinkedIn posts or maybe a blog post, maybe an edition of a newsletter, because there's so much locked up in those things that ends up just staying locked up, like in a podcast, for instance, that brands don't leverage. And then 6 months later, or maybe less, they kill the podcast because they say it's not working, when in reality, they never gave it a chance. So really, like, that's how I think about it, is I think rarely you can just start today and be like, oh, let's publish a blog post that's more interesting, or you have to have that other stuff built out. Like if you don't know how you frame the problem differently than everyone else, or how you position around the solution, the content becomes much harder, right? To create, like having a unique premise is much harder.
Yeah. So you're saying get a point of view that's really strong, understand how that point of view will impact the market and impact your customer. Like what can you actually help them with? That is unique. Mm-hmm. And then pull that together with the 5 P's, which I don't remember all of them, but I liked it. Yeah. I liked it a lot.
Problem, positioning, principles, premise, and packaging. Yeah.
There you Boom. Go. Pull that together.
Boom.
And then use that as your basis, and then it's much easier. And I mean, there's a lot of, you could do an episode on each one of these things. I think we did one recently with somebody about repurposing content that I think is very similar just to the packaging piece, that is by itself the thing that people miss, right? Yeah. Like back to Brandwagon, there was no vertical video world back then. That wasn't a thing. But if there had been, we basically made it to have clips, and probably we would have made all of the clips in the first place of like me trying to run my fastest mile time with an Olympic runner and all these crazy things that are in that show, which was very embarrassing, by the way, and terrifying. I thought I might die, but I did do it. And I think I ran a 6:15 fastest mile of my life. All you have to do is have a drone following you.
That is
fast.
it was, I mean, I shocked myself.
That is very impressive.
But like, I back to the packaging piece, I think it's interesting because had we done that and repurposed a lot of those episodes,
yeah,
I think we would have seen things take off in a way that would have changed how we evaluate it.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Even right now, just to give the Talking to Loud example, it's like Talking to Loud, solid. The core podcast, it's solid. Like, it grows. It doesn't grow super fast, but it grows.
Yeah.
But if you look at the amount of content we make with it that shows up on LinkedIn, well, that stuff does incredibly well. I mean, we're talking millions and millions of impressions, like a year, way more than that. And then if you look at the clips we make, those by themselves get millions and millions of impressions every month organically on a bunch of the like vertical video platforms. And so it's the whole thing you have to look at versus just only downloads. Like if you looked at only downloads, you'd be like, okay, like this is fun. This is good. Partnerships come out of it. We learn a lot, like blah, blah, blah. But like, it's not going insane. But then when you look at the whole package, I was like, oh,
this back is to what you were saying before, Sylvie, this is the hard part. I can't tell you how many people I talked to where they killed their podcast because it didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, we were getting 200 listens, you know, 10 episodes in. And I can't tell you how many times I've repeated this. I don't care if zero people download your podcast if you're doing what you just outlined, Chris. If you're getting not even millions, if you're getting thousands, tens of thousands of impressions all over social, if you're using it in your newsletter, if you're using it for a blog, if you're using it to curate original research, right? Because everybody you talk to like is an opportunity to kind of pull together qualitative research. Then it's like, you almost render the downloads for a specific podcast episode meaningless. Now, granted, once you start building that up, now it's great, awesome. We all want to have 10,000 downloads or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the hard part for people to get over that mental hurdle of, but nobody's downloading the podcast. This is a waste of time. It's only a waste of time if the content lives and dies in the podcast. But if you're using it for social, if you're using it for your newsletter, if you're using it for blog posts, we're using it in talks or whatever, like the impact that could have is almost endless.
Yeah, it's really like a paradigm shift, I think, for people to like think of, especially with a podcast, to think of it beyond downloads. I feel like we're just now starting to see something kind of different, maybe because podcasting is more in the video space, but like I think it's hard for people to not say, I cranked out this piece of content. Here's my one expectation from it rather than I cranked out this one piece of content. Here's my like 10 expectations for it. And maybe seven of them will come true.
Yeah.
Well, it is funny because like to go back to the 1 to 100 example, that is how we greenlit it. It was 10 ways it could work. It was like, the ads themselves might work. We're going to test them against each other. Maybe one of those works better. We're going to learn ourselves, like literally learning and development for the team because they're going to work with another group and like see how they solve this. We're going to probably get blog posts out of this. Oh, we're going to end up with a feature length doc about this. Okay, that could be its own thing. Then we're like, the trailer is going to cause people to see that a SaaS company made a documentary. And that there's going to be a benefit of that. And then there was an ad for the trailer that was like the 30-second version. And that's going to just tell people we made a trailer. And so we're looking at all these, like, well, there's literally, we're 10 things. And if seven of them work, we're crushing it. We actually set up so if like two of them worked, it would crush it. And I think it's the problem that a lot of people run into, and I've seen people have this challenge internally, is I know it's real, is like, well, I have one OKR. It's like, I have the one. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, no, it probably can affect 10. Like, but one, like I have one.
Yeah. This is when numbers create bad habits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you just start optimizing for the, if you get the OKRs wrong or you set the wrong expectations, you can be in a situation where you can have something that could be working really, really great and stop it short because it's easy to keep doing it once it's working, right? Like for us now, it's incredibly easy and fun to do Talking to Loud and continue to do it and grow it. But that's because we have all these different approaches to seeing it work and different ways it's worked over time. It's just, it would be stupid not to do it.
Yeah, you've nailed the packaging of it, which I think is the piece so many people miss with this stuff.
Yeah.
And once it all works, and not only, it's you're creating this flywheel where other content channels are benefiting from it, but then it all points back to the podcast, which eventually is going to lift the podcast too. So it's just like we were saying before, the compound interest. We're not giving things enough time. And I think a lot of that is just bad habits that were developed. And I'm not hating on SEO, but I just think that format and that approach to marketing created a lot of bad habits where it was like, numbers say this, I do this, I should see this immediately out on the other side. And for the most part, it kind of worked like that. It was magical for a long time. And now it's not. And it's a lot harder. And I think a lot of the things we're talking about is probably how marketing always was before the age of the internet, right? And we're just kind of going back to these like foundational.
Not Savage saying preach. I can't.
Taking to church. Yeah. It just,
mostly for yourself.
It's just, we're going back to these foundational truths that it's like to anybody who's probably been in the space for 40 years is probably looking back at us like these guys think they discovered. It's like, it's that's like right. Roy Christmas and Dumb and Dumber seeing that they landed on the moon. And he's like, we landed on the moon. He's like, that was like 50 years ago.
I think that's exactly right. It's like, if you've been like a marketer for a long time, you've seen this new wave come of perfect data. And then we've moved away from it. And they're like, oh, good luck to everybody. Have fun. Right? It's like when it's actually about story and brand and like getting someone to feel something. Leaving like a mark in their mind where they continue to think about you and you hold like a space and then they recommend you and you show up again and again. And like that takes work. And that work was always valuable. I think it's just back to the kind of beginning of the conversations. It's just becoming more valuable again in a world that's hard to measure, where SEO isn't working, where brand matters. Like you want to show up in AI, guess what? People have to talk about you.
And yeah, and how do you get people to talk about you? Yeah, this is, I borderline brought this up when you said, what am I talking too loud about? Which is, I'll stop short of saying that AI actually aligns with content, because I'm not naive enough to ever think that the algorithms of big tech is ever going to be a meritocracy 100%, right?
Yeah.
But the nature of AI, right? Like if I ask a question to Gemini or whatever, the nature of it is it can only cite so many things to me. And if I just pile on like the way we would with SEO and write the same article that's been written 1,000 times, but hey, I need to rank for it too. And if I optimize it better than you did, I'll outrank you.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the same thing 1,000 other people already said. So what is the likelihood I'm going to get cited? Now, if I flip that and say, well, I'm going to go against what everyone else is saying, not purposely, but I'm just going to share my own experiences now. I'm going to share what I've observed, what I've experienced in this space, maybe some contrarians that I don't necessarily believe that other people do. Now you're creating something that somebody else might reference in their newsletter or mention on a podcast or mention on social. And now you're in a better position to be cited by a Gemini because you said something different. You added something different to the conversation. You didn't just pile on to something that 1,000 other people already said. You went with what you think. And so I think that does sort of align with the content brand ideology, which is to focus first on what makes us different. Like what is different about my experience that I could bring to the table that's different from what everyone else has already shared and added to the conversation. And it kind of makes me hopeful that this could have a positive impact on content, but I don't think a lot of people are seeing it that way yet. I think they're just treating it like SEO and hoping that they're going to show up when people ask ChatGPT or Gemini. And it's like, the whole motivation is different and we have to recognize that.
To me, that feels like the short term versus the long term. It's like the short term, I think there's going to be easy things you can do to try to show up and people will treat it like SEO. And the long term, I think your point on you need to be different, but you need to do something that only you can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think about that a lot. It's like, what's the thing that only we can do? Like, what's the thing that we can do that we will be world-class at doing? And if you're world-class at doing something, usually it works, right?
Right.
And so it's like,
people notice.
Let's find our way to that. And that ultimately, means you're different. You're standing out. You're showing up. People are talking about it. But that also means that somewhere in there, you got to have taste. You have freedom to experiment. You have to know what you're good at, know what you're not good at. You have to be honest. And give yourself a chance. But that is ultimately what works over the long term.
Yeah. you have to be vulnerable in order to do all those things that you just said.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. And it is a big paradigm shift. I think Sylvie used that phrase earlier. But I almost think we're being forced into it as opposed to just like a new trendy tool. Like AI and these things are so disruptive and so foundational, almost like the internet. Like you didn't do the internet, like, right?
Yeah.
It was a whole thing. Like the AI, I think, is similar. It's not just something what we're going to do. I think it changes a lot. And I hope it has a positive impact on marketing and content as a whole. But like you said, there's always going to be ways to potentially game it. And I think that's where we're at now, like that initial phase. And I think a lot of people will stay there. But over the long term, I think it'll be interesting to see like how it changes the behavior of organizations as a whole, but specifically marketers.
This is like maybe an in there question, but like so much of what you guys are talking about is differentiation. How do, like, are there things brands can do? I guess you were talking about it before, John, when you were saying like you go back to some of the foundational stuff with brands before they even start making the content. But like, how can brands start getting in touch with their own uniqueness? Is that something?
It has to start, like, I honestly think it has to start with the problem that you're solving. And if you go to most SaaS websites now, if you go to most service providers' websites, it's usually very generic, built around a solution. And that could work when you have the brand behind it. Like if I go to HubSpot.com and it says grow better with HubSpot, that works. Everybody knows what HubSpot is. They're a public company, right? They're, you know, flirting with Salesforce and Dreamforce for, you know, in terms of their market share, their conference and all these things. They could pull that off. Most of us can't. And so I think getting clear on what the problem is you're solving beyond growing better, building pipeline, right? Like, which is what most people are doing. Like I put out a LinkedIn post not long ago where I took, talk about using AI. I took like, I don't know, the top 25 SaaS websites according to, I think I pulled them from like the MarTech graphic that Scott Brinker puts out with HubSpot. And I dumped it in there and I said, give me one homepage headline that could summarize B2B SaaS. And it was like something corny about like everything together all in one place. Like, right. It was like, you could read that one headline and be like, I think I just read 300 SaaS websites value props on their homepage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know which one, right? And I think getting clear on the problem and how you frame it is critical. I think that's where everything starts. That has to be the foundation. Because if you're not differentiating on the problem that you solve, the content, everything else is going to follow suit, right? And I just think it's really hard to differentiate when that isn't built in, like right from the beginning. So I think it really starts, what is different about the way you're framing the problem? Okay, your product helps people build pipeline. Why is that a problem? Why is pipeline so hard for brands to build? Okay, why? Like, keep going deeper on that.
Yeah. Ask,
like, what is your, only your, the, yeah. the lens to which you see the space, you had however many years experience in your space, you've talked to however many customers, you've been to conferences, you've sold. What is unique about the way you see it? Define why it's so hard to build pipeline and how your product solves that thing.
Yeah. I guess that's really what I'm asking. Like, keep going deeper on the why. Yeah.
That has to be the starting point, because then there's kernels in there, seeds in there that you could plant for, okay, we can create a premise around this for content. We can do all these other things like thought leadership and whatever else you want to invest in. But if that's not already established, and you'd be surprised how many people don't have that, right? If that's not established, I think everything else becomes that much harder because you're not even clear on it yourself.
I like to think of this as play only the game that you can play.
Yeah.
And it is the core why. It is the differentiator. It's like going deep. Like everything you said, I agree with. I think the truth of it is that there are, even when you look at why companies are started, there are a lot of companies that are started to be the cheaper version of something else, mm-hmm. to do it because another company is doing it. Like, if that's all it is, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, the content brand thing is not going to solve your problem.
Right.
Like,
right.
I think that's kind of the issue. It's like, if there's no soul, you can't put it in there.
Right. Right.
Gotta have soul.
You gotta have soul. And I think that
preach.
I think that is the other side. There are a lot of companies that actually do have the soul.
Yeah.
And they have, usually it looks like people who care deeply about what they're doing. they have some approach, their expertise on some angle that's showing up and how they're solving the problem. And then it's just basically shining the light on that, pulling it up, making it obvious. But yeah, it is so tempting to see someone else doing something and thinking, oh, that must be the way, when really the answer is almost always like, you should have the answer inside you somewhere.
Right. Yeah. And you do. I think most aren't conditioned to look there for inspiration. We're used to the secondhand strategy. And so I think that,
yeah,
to go way back to Sylvie's question about what's hard, that's the hardest part. It's like, I feel like it's actually easy once you're able to tap in, like, oh yeah, that's why I believe these things. It's almost, I don't want to compare these two things, but it's almost like going to therapy, right? You learn more about yourself that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to tap into without someone else's help, right? Asking you the right questions and bringing you to a place that, like, oh, okay, like, that's why I have no patience or whatever, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, I think it's almost a similar exercise where people might find it therapeutic, where it's like, that's why I believe these things. That's why I invest so hard in this. And I haven't really articulated that. Nobody's asked me that before. And I think so much stuff becomes easier. And I think the cheaper thing, I guess the only example I'd use for that maybe kind of worked is Southwest Airlines. Like, they set out to be the cheaper alternative for airlines, but they use that to inform everything. Like, why don't we have meals in the flights? Well, if we have meals in the flights, it's going to be more expensive, and we're not going to be the cheapest airline anymore. And some people really value that, right? Airline travel is expensive.
The way they treated their employees was different too, right? Like, right, from the very beginning, they had a culture that was set up of like employee ownership and like, hey, we're going to go and we're going to be this cheaper thing, but our quality of service is going to be really high and you're going to have a stake in how the business performs. And that, I feel like a lot of those elements were figuring out how to like play their own game. That was very different than anybody
else. And it's almost like the way they framed it too, which is like, you're trying to help the customer, you're trying to help them save money. Like, every decision should be placed through the filter of, is this going to help the traveler save? And, you know, I don't think a lot of SaaS positions like, well, hey, I think they really just try to be the cheaper alternative. And like you said, there's no soul to that. Whereas what Southwest did, I think there's a little bit of soul to that.
Yeah, you know? They made it like part of their DNA.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to argue against that, but I don't see that often in SaaS when you're trying to be the cheaper alternative. I just think people are just trying to undercut on price and steal market share. And sometimes it works, but most times it probably doesn't, especially for the brands that already have like trust built up, have a content brand built up. You can't copy that, right? Which I think goes back to the whole importance of doing it in the first place.
Totally. This was a super fun episode. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah,
likewise. Like, we covered a lot of like really interesting aspects, I think, of building a content brand. And it was fun to hear it from your perspective. It's fun to hear it on my podcast this time instead of you asking me questions on yours. So yes, thank you for coming on. John, where can people connect with you to learn more and follow along?
Well, there's the website, which is contentbrands.co. So C-O. Somebody else has .com, so eventually, I'll get that. And then LinkedIn. That's the social network I'm most active on. Just John Benigni on LinkedIn and contentbrands.co.
Amazing. So good to see you.
You as well. Thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
I just want to say, I didn't ask him on here just to talk about how great of a content brand was.
I mean, we paid him a lot of money. I want listeners and viewers to know that was a paid promotion. No, I mean, that must have been really cool to hear from someone sort of experiencing the Wistia brand outside of Wistia. I thought that was lovely.
Yeah, no, that was obviously awesome. And you can tell John and I have both spent a lot of time thinking about this. Like, thinking about how you build a brand that's centered around content that actually like lasts and stands out, gets people to care. And I think it's cool that he has done this with a bunch of different companies, both like being internal at those companies and then now doing his own agency. I've only done it at Wistia. So but it's just fun, and obviously care deeply about this. And it's always nice to get meta too. You know, it's nice to get in there talking about this, doing it here at Wistia, and then doing it with Talking Too Loud on Talking Too Loud.
There was so much meta.
If you saw us talking about that in the clips, if you saw it in the full episode, if you just listened, if you are reading a transposed version of this in the newsletter, who knows? But you saw it somewhere because we repackaged it.
The content is your oyster.
And that is what we're here to do. So wherever you are, this digital world, if you're an AI agent consuming the content or real even human being, we thank you and we appreciate you. And we'll see you in a couple weeks. But until then, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you consume the podcast. As always, you can send us feedback, guest ideas, topics for the show, random questions at ttlpod@wisty.com. And you can find Sylvie and I both on LinkedIn. Bye-bye.
Bye. Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia. Hosted by Chris Savage. Produced by me, Sylvie Lubau, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.